Welcome to Beer and a Movie, the podcast where we discuss the two greatest art forms known to humanity, beer and movies, sometimes achieving outstanding pairings, but other times giving ourselves the opportunity to wash the terrible taste of failure from our mouths. I am here every week. My name is Joe Hilliard, along with
Dave Gurney.
And what a treat. I always know we're going to have great conversations when she's here. It's Pam Briard.
I'm definitely here.
Pam and I talked a little bit, just briefly, on Friday evening before recording, and she had already seen the film. Uh-huh. She indicated to me that we probably owed her something for what we put her through on this. So I think we need something in our glass is what I'm saying, Joe.
It was this or watch Gene Dielman all again.
Oh, my God.
Do we give her the toughest assignments? Do you think that's what it comes down to, is when we get a tough movie, we think Pam can crack this with us?
I think that the discussion of going into this movie and how we picked our guests and all is ripe for After Hours. Patreon.com/Beer and a Movie Podcast. $5 a month gets you a free bonus episode every week. But yeah, you're right, David. Let's get something in our glass. I think this one's got a time limit.
It does, right? This is a series that folks are probably familiar with if you're in the craft beer scene at all. Stone Brewing, they've been around for ages now, right? They're definitely mm-hmm. part of that big boom that we had coming into the 2010s. This series that they've had, I don't know exactly how long they've been doing it, but quite a long time. I think at least a decade or more. It is their Enjoy By series, and these are each special recipes that they put together, and they are usually IPAs, I think always IPAs, and they are really just specifically made to be drank within a certain time frame so that you get the freshest of hop experience that you possibly can with beer.
There's an educational element to it too, because maybe beer drinkers had never thought about that before.
Right. I think you're right. In the 2010s is when people really, I started hearing people get you can't let the beer get too old.
Stone started in 1996, and the first Enjoy By was 2012.
Okay, right, in the 2010s. Very good. Thank you, Joe. So this one that they've done is their Enjoy By 4/2024, so April 20th of 2024. It is described as a hazy IPA. It is 9% alcohol by volume. Nice. As fresh can be is what you're trying to aim for. So here we are. We're recording before the 20th. We're going to get some of this in our glasses, and we'll see just how fresh and tasty this is. At 9%, I told Pam we need something a little bit heftier than normal, I think, for the discussion of this film this week.
Well, between the can and the glass, the moment I cracked it, I got an aroma of
oh man,
real really? Fresh hops.
Like pineapple. Oh man, that is super tropical.
There's a lot of flavor in the glass. Having not taken a sip, I'm looking forward to this a lot.
Have either of you watched Top Chef Wisconsin?
Yes. I haven't. I'm not caught up.
Did you see that? But I did see the episode.
Yes, I did. Those are tough to cook.
That was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
hops was an ingredient in a Top Chef episode.
Yeah. Yes, they
check that out.
They all had to make a dish with hops.
That's right. Yeah,
and different kinds of hops.
Yeah, love Top Chef. I've been watching since the first season. Still love it. And yeah, Wisconsin finally getting some love on the Top Chef. I'm hoping that this beer brings us some love because, Joe, this movie, you knew going into it that I was not, I mean, I was of two minds, looking forward to it, but girding myself, like really just tensing up about the entire thing.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to it because of Alex Garland's name. I was probably, of the three of us at the time, the biggest fan of Men. I don't know if that's...
I like Men quite a bit.
Divisive film. I took my daughter to go see it. She hated it.
It's a tough one.
And Ex Machina, Annihilation, not so much for me, but Ex Machina is one that all should see. I think it's a fantastic little movie. So Alex Garland, writer, of course, also of 28 Days Later.
Right.
Here he is again in something for now. I mean, it feels like something for now. What I didn't know was how he was going to, I mean, outside of the trailer, which shows some aerial footage of Washington getting, in a war zone, Jesse Plemons in that little... He's got a tiny little role here, but he's so scary in the trailer.
Big in the trailer. Mm-hmm. Based on the trailer, you'd think he's going to be a prominent piece of it.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
Well, but, it might have been a small role, but he did have a prominent piece. He has the most important question of the whole film.
I agree.
That but the question very I had big moment. Walking into it was, how was he going to address something that is clearly of the moment?
Of the moment, he was writing it during the pandemic, kind of right after, I think, the 2020 elections had happened. as many people, you know, kind of trapped in their homes, thinking about this thing going on that has these kind of global repercussions, you know, that he stumbled onto a scenario where he would play out, like, what happens if America plunges into civil war? You know, it's a harrowing kind of idea, but one that I think is probably worth exploring. So I was, again, excited to see what Garland would do with it, because like you, I am a fan. I think he does really amazing stuff on film, and you can't pigeonhole him, right? Mm-hmm. These projects you've just talked about, mm-hmm. Annihilation and Ex Machina, yes, are sci-fi, and this one is kind of
speculative.
I mean, it's hard to call it science fiction because technology really hasn't progressed to any great extent, and you don't know exactly what year we're in. And
yeah, but there are no cell phones.
Right. But I imagine that's the networks are down, right?
So it's a dystopian war film, came out this year, 2024, starring a carload of journalists whose goal is to get from New York City to Washington, D.C., because the president, who we see in the trailer, played by Nick Offerman, has not given an interview for 14 months. And they are photojournalists. They are grizzled veterans of all of this. In fact,
well, three of them are.
Right. Kirsten Dunst is well known as being, you know, one of the best out there. And right. So you said one of them. The fourth person in their car, third person in their car, Stephen McKinley Henderson, a.k.a. Bo's psychiatrist in Bo is Afraid.
That's right. Many roles that he's had over the years. He has a great part in Lady Bird. He plays the drama mm-hmm. teacher and has that like lovely expressive breakdown with the kids. It's great, great moment.
Say your last name for me. Kaylee Spanny?
Spanny from Priscilla.
A.K.A. Priscilla.
Which from watching, it took me a while to place her, honestly, as I was watching this. As much as I like Priscilla, I guess, you know, the way she was kind of the hair, the mm-hmm. makeup, everything from Priscilla was very different than what she is here presenting.
And something I think we'll get into is the lack of context as to why the Civil War is occurring. We are just now in the middle of it as the film goer. And these four journalists are trying to get to Washington, D.C. to ultimately see, well, spoilers now, the downfall of the president. Yeah. But the president, in a great little opening scene, is practicing a speech he's going to give on TV about how the United Western Forces, California and
Texas
yeah. have seceded and are waged war against the American government. Again, no context. Why is it happening? What caused the Civil War? All we know are little bits and pieces. This is a third term president. He has dismantled the FBI. So we've got some slippery slope stuff going into fascism. And
a tyrannical.
And fired yeah. rockets on citizens.
Right.
I thought the political decontextualization was brilliant.
I know some people are having trouble with that. I don't. I think they drop just enough in there to give you a framework to kind of understand how something like this unfolds. And yes, there are certainly parallels in that we have people who have spoken such things, who have said that they would, or in that have tried to hold on to power past mm-hmm. their term expiring. And so the idea of this kind of thing unfolding makes, you know, some level of sense, but it's not so targeted that you can hear the exact, I mean.
And the notion that California and Texas have banded together is very interesting given the current political landscape, because these are two states that don't agree on much.
Yeah, but Northern California is pretty conservative. Well, but I want to go back to that decontextualization. Sure. I thought it did two things really, really well. It heightened the tension because every time they had an encounter along the way, it was very unclear who the good guys and who the bad guys
absolutely.
Were.
It doesn't let you pick sides very much.
And I thought that was a really clever way to create tension.
Right.
And the second thing I think it did was, you know, if it had come out that this person was a bad guy and this person was a good guy, it would have polarized people's experience of the movie right away. And because it didn't do that, it sort of kept the action right in the moment, because this is a movie that's really about the interpersonal interactions between those four characters. In between the action, it's all these tight close-up shots of people's faces mm-hmm. as they try to sort of work their way through all the things that they're feeling about this experience that they're happening. And I thought that sort of decontextualization really kept that action right on the characters and less about what your political affiliation is.
Yeah, so what the film becomes in is a road trip movie with these four characters, some other characters coming and going as they go from New York to D.C. through a circuitous route because of the main arteries of traffic are all clogged up.
Yeah.
So we see these small town moments where they're meeting people, including Jesse Plemons, who's digging a mass grave to put who in exactly? I came to the
dumping
conclusion,
bodies into a mass grave.
But they weren't military bodies, so I think it was just foreigners, because clearly that character had a shoot first, ask question later if you're not, quote-unquote, American.
What kind of American are you?
Yes.
That's the question. What kind of American are you?
Right.
The action eventually gets us to the White House, where the president is overthrown by the United Western Forces. Our team, the people that we're following, have got first glance access to who's going to take a photo of the president getting shot.
The whole framing of this as being like us following these war reporters, these you know, war photographers, journalists into the field while they are chronicling this war that's unfolding, I thought was really brilliant. And I thought was actually made a topic that, as scared as I was going into it, more accessible and palatable to me, because you have these figures who are wrestling with this thing. Like, I'm bearing witness to it. I'm also part of it. And what part of me is operating in what moment, right? You get those moments, and this isn't all that unfamiliar. I mean, there are films that have done this with war reporting, right? The Year of Living Dangerously, Welcome to Sarajevo. We've seen these kind of – the struggle that a journalist
Salvador,
has.
Salvador, the trailer for Salvador in the Alamo pre-show.
Right, the Oliver Stone film, yeah.
Didn't you feel like you were watching a Frontline episode?
In some ways. But those moments of them wrestling with, like, Kirsten Dunst, you know, where she kind of shuts down there as they're, you know, approaching the White House in that final siege that's going on.
The heaviest military battle that we'd seen in the film prior.
Where, you know, she's just lost this close colleague, somebody who she clearly looked up to some extent, and who's played beautifully. Yeah. I mean, all the performances here are top notch. I mean, Kirsten Dunst for many years has been somebody who's just, every time I see her, I'm impressed by her. Kaylee Spanny is fantastic from top to bottom. All the, even the smaller characters here who pop up, those people they meet, in the, you know, the stops that they make. So to have them kind of, have these moments of kind of withdrawal. I love the moment where we see, and I can't, what's the male character who's,
Wagner Mora is his name. He's Joel.
Okay. When Joel is screaming and we're just, we don't get the sound of his voice. We have music overlaid it. I think it's the Sturgill Simpson song that they're playing right then. This is right after, they've lost their colleague. Mm-hmm. Those expressions of grief, that like how the reality of it dawns upon them, then how they get separated from that and they're able to maintain that kind of objective position for a moment. And then they get charged up by it and the kind of adrenaline rush of being surrounded by this.
Didn't you think the music was almost another character?
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes scores are overlays. Like, I didn't like the music in Oppenheimer because I thought he was playing tricks with it.
Yeah.
To heighten the tension when it wasn't really needed.
Yeah.
But the music in this was almost another character, and especially in the sequence where they're going through the forest.
Oh, that's the Sturgill Simpson song, the embers.
The tracers of light and everything. Yeah. And I just thought, wow. They also use silence very effectively in this movie, because in that first scene where the bomb goes off and Kirsten Dunst shields the young girl, and there's no sound, and it's just all about what's happening on people's faces and how they're looking around and everything. And it just plunges you into the feeling of it in a way that I'm not sure it could have done if there had been a lot of noise and emotion.
Yeah.
And one of the tricks that I thought they used really effectively was they would silence the war coverage, the war action around us in the sound design of the film when a photograph was taken.
Right.
And you, I guess, were to imagine that the photojournalist is there blocking out all of the gunfire and explosions to just get those shots.
Yeah. The sound in this film, I think, is incredible, because this is, you know, Garland is a filmmaker, I think, who was smart enough with this film. And I think it was there in the other films, too, if I think back on it. But like here, I think very prominently, constantly using sound as like a counterpoint to image in a way, like letting the image have its meaning for you, but then giving you this other sound that kind of complicates it, as opposed to what you're saying with Oppenheimer, Pam. It's about like amplifying the thing. It's like boom, 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 bomb is going up. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I get it, Christopher Nolan. You can make things loud and you can make the theater shake. Alex Garland, on the other hand, gives you these moments of like, you know, your stomach is in knots. You feel that, you can feel the tension. And then he's giving you like kind of a, he uses a couple suicide songs that are just like, they have that, you may remember like a really cheap drum machine beat sounding thing. It's just, it's got this funny, like different kind of tension to it that plays off and has a different feeling than the image does for
me. Well, and I thought he used the escalation of tension brilliantly in this movie because, you know, there'd be a scene like, you know, those crazy car chase scenes where it would build, and then there'd be this sort of moment where you were just waiting for the anxiety to let off.
Yeah.
And he would let it off just a bit, but he wouldn't really give you resolution. So he'd sort of pull back a little bit, and then he'd push it a little bit farther. And towards the end of the film, he constantly seesaws between that, never really giving resolution. Because, you know, when I watched this movie, when I went out to my car to leave, I had to sit in my car because I couldn't drive.
Yeah.
And as I was sitting there thinking about the movie, I thought, I can't remember the ending.
Oh, wow.
And then I thought about it, and then I was able to remember it and everything. Oh. But I think it was because he just kept on ratcheting up the adrenaline to this point where when the ending finally happened, yeah, they killed the president, but there's no resolution. You're just like, oh, my God, what's next? I mean, he left people sort of hanging on that edge of anxiety in a way that I thought was really tight and very, very clever.
Yeah. No, it does not give you relief.
There's no release.
There's no sense that, okay, like now you can breathe. It really is. Yeah. No, I didn't quite get there, but I did cry more during this movie than I thought I was ever going to.
Do you remember the parts that
I remember specifically the Jesse Plemons scene, like when he shoots just cold-bloodedly right there when he says, when the guy says he's from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And I was shedding tears, like instantly. I wasn't even thinking about it.
And he already killed the other guy.
Yes.
The other kind of peripheral friend who's not one of the main four gets Jesse Plemons proving a point. I am in control. You could die.
Part of it is the scenario. Part of it is, okay, yes, we're making it very clear. This is, you know, based on, you know, this discrimination that this guy, this bias that he has. But also, I think the performance of, and I'm not going to know the character's name, the Hong Konger who ends up getting shot. And he was amazing. I mean, he's breaking down there, shaking. Like, he can't even speak a word. It felt so real to me. Like I said, without even thinking about it, I just started crying. And then a little bit later, as they're those shots of the White House. You've all been to D.C., right? I remember I was there last fall.
It's like sacred.
And just walking in front of it. And it's just like this beautiful. And I was there with Aaron and the girls. And I was even, you know, and just to think like, oh, this place that I think of as being part of our experience and part of what we have to maybe, I don't know, identify ourselves. It's a symbol, right? It's to see that in this kind of a situation. It was just like, it really kind of, you know, upset me on this deep, deep level.
And, you know, that Jesse Plemons scene. The thing that I took away from that is, you know, leading up to that, they're sort of going through, there's all these bucolic scenes of
how beautiful
green
is this
lawns
film in some ways.
And sprinkler heads, you know, twirling around. And then
when
he shoots
the
guy, it's so banal.
Yeah. The city that was ignoring it, I knew we'd get into. One of the things I had to look up as soon as I got home was how they duplicated the White House. This was like part of the battle. The White House battle there at the end unfolded at Tyler Perry's 330-acre studio in Atlanta, which contains a replica of the White House already. Other sections, like the 30-foot-tall makeshift barrier surrounding the White House, were constructed in nearby. Blue screen CGI. There was a JCPenney, I remember, that was in disrepair.
Mall.
And finding a dead mall is easy in America. But did they CGI the damage to the mall, I imagine? Really, really, really well
Hopefully
done.
They didn't use AI.
So they enter on their little road trip. They go to a town that seems to be ignoring everything that's happening. There's a dress shop that's opened up. They go inside just to see, hey, there's a civil war going on? we're just trying to ignore the whole thing. We're staying out of it. What'd y'all think of that part? It's clearly, to me, that was the most largest telegraphed message of the whole movie. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well,
I
think I would agree with that because I think the message was you ignore this at your peril. You know, that the time for indifference is over. And, you know, if you're ignoring this, you're not paying attention.
But they weren't ignoring it. They had the snipers on
the
roofs. They had
found
a way.
Be inconspicuous. Look around at the top of the building.
I mean, they were isolating themselves. My assumption is they had guards posted at strategic points around at least the downtown area, and they were being very controlling about who they let in. A press vehicle, they had determined, okay, this doesn't we don't need to stop this. We'll monitor them from the rooftops. Well, you know what I mean?
Like, but so the illusion of normality is even more dangerous.
Well, I can understand that. And I do, I definitely got from that scene this sense of there is a way that, you know, people, even within a war or the, you know, a live war that's going on, there are going to be pockets of people who are able to kind of cordon themselves off. I mean, you see it in, you know, films about World War II and, you know, like that people live out in the countryside. And yes, the war is passing by them. There are battles going on just like, you know, miles down the road from where they are. It, they can see the fire at night. But then when you get to their farm, like, okay, they're running things and they're able to maintain, you know, the farmer being visited in, you know, Inglourious Bastards, that first scene. I mean, yeah. So we've seen that kind of thing before. To me, it reminds me, like, there are these sort of oases that people create for themselves. Now, again, whether that can be maintained, how long it can be maintained, that's all a different question. But there are these kind of moments where people cordon themselves off. To me, it was the moment where the reporter's like, wow, how does this even exist? And then they see the sniper's like, oh, that's how they exist. They have a coordinated effort going on here. They've closed down. They've locked down their town.
But don't you think it's also about the fact that telling the truth doesn't really have a lot of traction?
Certainly, yeah. I mean,
you know,
or, but yeah. I mean, and a reminder that, like, okay, but you're, the reality of these things can be kept at arm's length as long as you're able to keep them at arm's length. You know what I mean? And as you say, that you, that may not last forever, and you may have to eventually just kind of give in and recognize, okay, no, there is a war going on and my nephew is dead and my, you know, whoever. But, you know, for a time they're trying. I don't know. It was an interesting scene. I liked the different variations we get, right? Them stopping at the gas station, seeing the men hanging in the car wash.
I knew that guy. Yeah. Went to high school together.
Very much that, look, neighbors have turned against neighbors. Mm-hmm. That in the desperation of the situation, people
they were
turned
looting.
Mm-hmm. And now, okay, to be made example of, we see other bodies hanging from, like, overpasses, right? And there are those.
And it's not a close-up on them. It's a long shot of them going underneath a highway.
Yeah.
And I, you know, if you missed it, you missed it. But no, on most bridges, there were people hung.
Yeah.
That's why I think the interaction between the four characters was really so important, because it was sort of making it personal. And one of the things I really loved about it was this sense of almost what I would describe as sort of intergenerational nurturance. I mean, you see it sort of obviously with the Kirsten Dunst and the young woman character, and, you know, they're struggling with, how do you tell the story and what does it mean? But you see it also with Kirsten Dunst and the older man who's her mentor. And you see it with the other male character sort of trying to mentor, hit on the young woman.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's sort of like when Kirsten Dunst says to her, you just have to go in and take the shot.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get involved. And she's trying to explain to her how they're witnesses, you know, and I think
we let the readers make the judgments.
I think one of the reasons why that's important is because the action is interpersonal. It's not technology based, and it's about not just the political divide in the U.S., but, you know, sometimes the generational divide between how people relate to each other and how they decide how it's important to relate to each other. And that sort of dissolves in this little nest of these very tight relationships in a situation of crisis.
I do think that's a powerful part of the film. You know, one of the places they stop that really stood out to me too was when they go to that stadium, and it's been used as kind of like a refugee camp, essentially, where all these people who've been displaced.
There's a canteen where you can get a meal. There's a shower. Right.
There's no tents.
No tents available for them, but it's a tent city. I mean, there's all these, but there's shots there of children laughing, people playing,
playing
craft
double
tables,
Dutch, jump rope.
They're jumping. Again, like that kind of, That sort of disharmony that goes on in my head where I'm like, oh my God, this, but you have to soldier on. You have to, like, in a situation like this, you'd have to find a way to find some joy in those moments that you can, even though your town has been ruined, even though they've just bulldozed.
And even our four little group that we're following do with the buddies that come up aside and they're playing on the freeway and jumping back and forth in the cars.
Yeah.
In what ultimately becomes the tragedy at the Jesse Plemons site, where he's digging a mass grave to put somebody in it, and I still don't know who's going into that grave.
Well, there are a lot of women and children in the grave. Do either of you remember there was a little scene where there was the Pledge of Allegiance, or they were talking about the Pledge of Allegiance?
I think
in
the
some way?
President is giving the Pledge of Allegiance in one of his voiceover speeches.
Okay. That took me back to junior high.
Oh.
when I was on the student council.
Okay.
And somebody from the student council would come in the principal's office every morning and recite the Pledge of Allegiance over the loudspeaker. Mm-hmm.
For the entire school, yeah.
Yeah, for the entire school. And that was like a privilege to be able to do that. And of course, I love doing that, you know. And it just took me right back to being like 12 years old.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And how it could be sort of transformed from this moment of pride and and togetherness to something really
very sinister. Yeah. This is an intense film. I recommend it to those who go in with open eyes. I mean, I think this is a pretty tough film in many ways. Like, it does affect me very deeply. I don't know that I'm going to be rushing to watch it again anytime soon. I probably will watch it someday again, hopefully, if we avoid this.
When I was sitting
future.
In my car trying to go home, I thought, should I go back in and watch it again?
Yeah. So you want to see it right now. You're ready to get back in there.
Well, you know, I wanted to see if
I'd go see
the way
the
I was
friends.
Feeling about it was what I was really thinking. But, you know, it was a very tight movie. It was shot, I thought, incredibly well. Very, very tight.
Yes.
And I think the fact that he wasn't an American probably helped him do it.
Probably. I think you're right. He gets us pretty well because he's an outside observer.
Yeah, Alex Garland is English. The ending of the film. So, Priscilla, I don't think any of it. I'm sorry. I'm going to do that to her. I apologize. I know her as Priscilla now. Is a young photographer looking up to the Kirsten Dunst character. So the idea that she's in a car with her in this situation as they head to the White House to maybe get some amazing shots, there is a protege mentor thing going on the whole time as they finally settle into one another. The ending shot of the film, or the ending scene of the film, shows Kirsten Dunst throwing her out of the way, Priscilla out of the way, to take a bullet that would have been meant for her. A little too on the nose for you guys, or is that the character arc that you ultimately thought was the most satisfying?
They kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They kind of hinted, foreshadowed that was going to be, because, you know, they kept on talking about the death shot and how that's the most famous shot and everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, I saw it as more than a mentoring relationship. I really saw it as a nurturing relationship in some essential kind of way.
Kindred spirits, recognizing that they were very similarly driven people. They had this, it was a beautiful relationship. I thought.
Well, that was me once upon a time, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Kirsten Dunst, the mentor.
Exactly, yeah. And like, and her, like, why did I put myself on this path? You shouldn't go on this path. You know, those kind of moments where it's, you know, we often think of mentors as the ones who, like, tell us, yes, this is the path. But she's actually kind of doing everything, at least initially, to say, this isn't the path.
You know, I've been very fortunate to have older women in my life who have been able to give me guidance and direction. And you know, in ways that your parents can't really do because you're too close to them in some ways.
Right.
And I think it was really a bidirectional relationship, because there's that beautiful scene when they're in the Twilight Zone town where they're trying on clothes.
Yes,
and
yes,
Kirsten
yes.
Dunst is looking in the mirror and she's in this beautiful dress. And you could just see her face kind of moving around the idea that, you know, her life could have been different in some way and how important that is. And when I was watching that, I thought about the scene in the Julianne Moore movie that we talked about.
Oh, May-December, yeah.
May-December, where they're in the mirror putting on their makeup, and it's so artificial and contrived, and it's so much about creating this persona. And this was so much rawer and more real in some way.
Very beautiful. Yeah,
I
beautiful,
thought.
Absolutely. Touching in this way, where, because it wasn't something she would really do herself. It was the younger woman, right? Kaylee's character. I've got Jesse here is the one who's compelling her to try on the dress. She's seeing her.
Jesse's reminding her to be human.
Yeah. Right. Or putting her in touch with, you are, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. You're not just the neutral observer. You are also a participant. You get to be a person.
And you're a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. What a great film. I mean, again, I can't see myself rushing to go back out to see this because it is such a downer for me, but it is so well put together. I've already named Suicide, Love, Sturgill Simpson, that Skid Row shows up when they're chasing in the truck, that the truck is chasing them. Aaron recognized that one for me.
I didn't see it as so much of a downer as the verisimilitude was so fractionally close to the ways that people are feeling about things.
Oh, yeah, that's it, yeah.
That it was disturbing. And there's this woman, you know, even though I'm not working as a psychologist anymore. I'm still into psychological stuff, who just published this book called Magical Thinking and Conspiracies. And she talked about the fact that, you know, when a society or a world like we've been living in for the last 5 years goes through this sort of major catastrophic event, people look for big reasons and they gravitate to magical thinking. You know, if I just imagine myself, I can do this, it's going to be great. Or they gravitate to conspiracy theories. And it's almost like the everyday things in life that make us behave the way we do or circumscribe our behavior in important kinds of ways don't satisfy us as explanations. We want bigger things. We want bolder things. And I think the reason why this movie worked is the violence was casual and believable because of the casualness of it. And it just felt like something that could be true.
Well, that's exactly why I find it so disturbing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a really, because horror films, I've talked about this on the podcast. Horror films in general, I have no problem with. Supernatural horror. Mm-hmm. I'm not somebody who's like, I think I understand how the universe works and there's no such thing as an afterlife. No, I'm not that person. But I'm somebody who is, I've never encountered it. I've never had to deal with it. This is so remote from my experience. Let it do what it does. You know, like, and this will be chilling, but afterwards, you know what? No ghosts have spoken to me. And like, maybe someday they will, but until then, I can just have fun with this. Civil War, on the other hand, every single moment, I'm like, yeah, I've been next to somebody who's said something like that. I've felt that kind of energy come from a person before.
I was buying tennis shoes the other day and I went in and I told him exactly the ones I wanted. And he said, oh, and I was waited on by an older gentleman. He's like, these are our second most popular shoe next to Hoka's. And I said, oh, really? I said, did you know the president wears Hoka? And he's like, I don't want to talk about that. Let's talk about something else. He's like, he probably doesn't even dress himself. And I wanted to say, dude, you are trying to sell me a $200 pair of tennis shoes. Chillax. All I said was that he wore them. Yeah, you know, I didn't say it was good or bad or anything. And I just thought.
Well, and also, it undercuts his bottom line. If he's a salesperson, right, shouldn't he want you to be excited about these top-selling shoes in his store that are even more expensive?
Not probably? If the wrong person's wearing them, David.
Yeah, I don't know.
The other thing I want to mention is I was thinking that clearly Alex Garland was making us think Purple Mountain's Majesty, Amber Waves of Grain. Yeah. There were so many gorgeous, not only the antithesis of war, children doing double Dutch jump rope, moments of joy, bursts of joy. There are moments where we are shown the beautiful majesty of the American land over and over. Flowers, rivers.
Yeah. Green grass.
And then you're getting this beautiful helicopter shot a la The Shining, you know, through Colorado, but over this beautiful lake. Yeah. And then here come from the edges the helicopters just to remind you, like, we've got so much good. Let's not turn it bad.
It feels that way for sure. Yeah.
Huge recommend. See it in the theater. See it immediately.
Did you see it in IMAX?
I did not. I went to Alamo.
Aaron and I on the way out said, like, because I remember seeing it advertised, see it in IMAX. I'm like, kind of glad we didn't see that one in IMAX. Is what Aaron said.
My heart rate was so high when I left the theater. I thought, I'm glad I didn't see it in IMAX.
I listened to an interview with Garland talking about how I didn't think this, it wasn't shot for IMAX.
Yeah.
And I hoped that the transfer to the larger format was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And then he must have gone to the premiere that was at IMAX, gave a speech, and left.
Oh.
He didn't even see it. IMAX, but IMAX not necessary, theater screen necessary, and if you can't get there, definitely check it out on streaming. This is one I think I will go see it again if the right person asks, hey man, did you see, you know, there's a lot there that
need a few years between me and him.
I want to just say one last thing about the Kirsten Dunst death scene, you know, when she sacrifices herself for the girl, and one of the things she did for Jesse was value her potential.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and, you know, if you think about it, you know, that's one of the greatest things that we do for other people is we say, hey, I see you. I see your potential. I see what you can become. I saw that the other night at the Barbie screening because the students were sitting there talking about intersectionality and, you know, white feminism and stuff.
Right.
And I was like, oh, my God, I just missed that. I just missed that energy of these minds lighting on fire and talking about all these wonderful ideas. And that was sort of the ultimate recognition of her potential in that sort of denouement of death.
Right, sacrificing herself for the greater good, for progress, for things to be able. Yeah, no, it's a beautiful film. It really is. Alex Garland, and he's not going to direct anymore now.
See, but that
it's probably fine.
On what you read, that's not a true statement.
Really?
Yeah.
He
had been you know.
Okay.
That the misquoting became the story. Yeah. So that sometimes it's difficult to get out.
For sure, we have the 28 years later coming soon, right?
Civil War II, 28 years later?
No, they're doing a 28 days later. That he wrote.
Very
that
nice.
Danny Boyle,
So. Did you like the second 28 days?
Yeah, I did. I loved 28 weeks,
one.
Yeah.
First one was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Well, don't wait to see the movie, but are we right to not wait to drink this beer? Because they say in 6 days, on recording date, it's losing its freshness. This is the 420 Enjoy By Stone. I've had how many of these 420s have you had? I've had a half a dozen probably through the years.
I mean, the Enjoy By series at least, yeah. The 420 ones, I guess probably at least three or four of them over the years. I mean, yeah, that's a regular date for them to target. I liked it. It was very, as soon as we poured it, the aroma I thought was great. Went in for the sip, and for me, most of what I was smelling there, I was getting in the flavor. It's a little bit more bitter when you actually taste it than what you're getting in the aroma. But overall, very citrusy, tropical, very easy to throw back, 9%. I did not feel like it was 9% as I was drinking it. So now I do that I'm talking about
it. A little
bit. Great.
My pink cheeks feel like it's 9%.
Did you like the flavor, Pam?
I did.
Good.
Yeah, this is a solid IPA.
Yeah.
I think they have it on tap at one of our local favorite tap bars, and I might try to go grab a drink of this before 420, just in the spirit of
good
the thing.
Idea.
Can IPAs go bad? I mean, that's the concept. That's why I say an educational element. It's reminding beer drinkers that IPAs have an expiration date. I pulled up an article. Here it says, if you're buying an IPA 3 months after the bottle date, you're getting an inferior product. Mm-hmm. That hop freshness. Well, begins to erode.
Growing up in Wisconsin, there were definitely seasons to beer.
Yeah.
Like most people's experience of Bock beer is not real Bock beer, because Bock beer is when the brewery in the springtime cleans out their vats and brews from the sludge that's in the vat. And Bock beer.
Huh.
Yeah. And then Weiss beer,
yeah,
which used to be huge in Wisconsin, which is very cloudy, hazy wheat beer, is a spring beer, usually around Easter. So, I mean, I think beer used to be more seasonal.
For sure. And certainly over in Europe, right? That German beer tended to be very Oktoberfests and Mars, it kind of just brings back some of that, you know, history of beer, that it was something brewed for a certain time and you enjoyed it then, and then you would have the next thing that came along. Here, you know, I think we may be obsessing about a particular component of the beer that's making us want to. Yeah, right. Joe and I.
Joe, I, and many others, because, in our local beer groups, there's all kinds of, tattletale photos of beers on the shelf in local stores that are 6 months, 8 months past IPAs.
Four years. No, there are beers that I've had people send me a picture of the bottom of the can with that date on it, and it'll be years in the past.
Right. And it's for sale now in IPA.
You know, and a lot of styles don't hold up forever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's heavier, darker beers do tend to, I think, weather time a little bit better.
Right.
But lighter beers, you're not doing them any favors by, sitting on them for a long time. Yeah.
Well, this one was great. Good job, Stone. Thank you.
Yes.
All right. Well, there's even more Civil War, war-torn streets of America coming at you in the second half. So just wait.
It is time.
I hope you guys Ubered over, because we are venturing to a new brewery, Hangar 24 Brewing. We have not been there before, David. Let me read a long thing on the side of this bottle. Get ready for an assault on your senses. Whoa. This rich black beauty is bursting with aromas of chocolate, vanilla, oak, bourbon, licorice, and dark fruits. While flavors of sweet malt, bourbon, and roasted coffee explode on your palate, this is no ordinary beer. Three different dark roasted malts and rich maple syrup combine in a truly unique brewing process to create complexity and depth. This is their barrel roll series, Pugachev's Cobras, aged in bourbon barrels for 8 months, 13% ABV.
Oof.
Russian Imperial Stout brewed with maple syrup and aged in bourbon barrels.
Wow.
How do you think that's going to pour?
Pouring dark as midnight.
They age scotch and bourbon barrels, too.
Yeah.
And sometimes sherry barrels.
I love a good barrel note on an Imperial Stout.
Oh, sure.
It's been a while since we've had one. I feel like, you know, there was an era in beer in a movie. At some point, we'll break down the data. We'll think back on what that window of time was, where I feel like we were having barrel-aged stouts like every other week sometimes. We've kind of backed off that, but it's exciting to have one come back in. I'm ready for it, I think.
That smells like alcohol.
It smells like molasses.
Oh, with maple.
Yeah, yeah, like in chocolate. Oh, my God. That is a dessert. That is like a boozy chocolate cake with like a gooey. Oh, I want this dessert.
You're getting gooey chocolate cake from your nose. Oh.
You're not?
I'm happy you're here.
Love it.
Very, very good. I can't wait. Back in episode 61, David,
like brownie batter. That's what I'm thinking. I'm just telling you, this is amazing. It's got a great nose.
I can offer you a chocolate croissant.
I don't want to stop. I don't want to stop you describing this thing. Back in episode 61, though, David, you might remember we did 6 John Carpenter films. John Carpenter from 1980 to 1994. The first film we discussed was The Fog. The second film was The Thing, 1980, 1982, respectively. But in 1981, Escape from New York was released. So we get to fill in a hole here. Carpenter, we've done 8 times.
Yeah, this is exciting. I mean, I think the reason why we left Escape from New York out of that 6-episode blitz, mm-hmm. or 6-film blitz.
It was horror October episode.
Yeah, this wasn't horror, right? I mean, Escape from New York is decidedly sci-fi action, kind of dystopian sci-fi action film from John Carpenter. For those who are unfamiliar with the film, the basic premise is that you have a then-future New York. This is one of those films, folks, where you're watching it now in 2024.
We didn't get it right.
You may have some little giggles. It's good that it's good that John Carpenter's vision of 1997 did not come to pass. It talks about that in 1988, the United States sort of goes into this death spiral where there's a 400% jump in the crime rate.
Mm-hmm.
They decide
they're at war with Russia
and China. Yeah, maybe they just waited a few years. It could no. They've walled off around Manhattan Island and turned it into essentially a maximum security prison where they are just keeping all of the criminals in the country, apparently, concentrated in this one spot in the United States.
This movie came out in 1981. I was 9. I saw it on video several times.
Mm-hmm.
Think about deserting New York City. Think about everything that happens in New York City. How bad did this crime rate have to be for people to move out businesses, to move out?
Well,
in the 70s, crime was awful in New York. I probably have the perspective on this in that, you know, I went to high school and college during the 70s, and you know, it was post-Vietnam. The president had been forced to resign. The economy was shit. We had gas rationing.
Right.
And my first car loan was at 18% interest rate. Wow. And then we had the Iran-Contra.
Right. The hostage crisis.
Situation. Yeah. Yeah. And then Reagan got elected, and he sprayed all the weed fields with paraquat.
Yeah.
Because people were smoking too much weed.
Yeah.
And so there was a kind of angst about the late 70s, early 80s, that things were, I mean, it was before yuppies and before the economy picked up again, that I think this movie actually reflects pretty well.
Well, Carpenter wrote it in the mid 70s, and he was trying, like, it was something that he was working on getting made for
a few years. In reaction to the Watergate scandal.
That's what he says. And again, like Pam said, I mean, even if you don't think about the total context, New York City was in huge decline at that point. The 70s had not been a good decade for New York City. People had fled the city. The suburbs were booming. What you had left were lots of vacant spaces. This is the era of like punk taking off and no wave and art and stuff, because people could rent lofts for like no money at all because there was nobody staying in downtown New York.
Have you ever read any William Gibson?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a speculative fiction writer, and he credits watching Escape from New York with, you know, really the impetus for his writing career. And you know, he's considered sort of the father of cyberpunk.
Yes.
And you know, he was writing about things like the internet and, you know, AI and stuff long before anybody else was writing about them.
Well, so in this backdrop of this dystopian future where New York is now just a prison, what we have is a situation where a rebel group has hijacked Air Force One.
Yes.
And is trying to get...
Flew it into a New York building, David.
Yes.
There's oppressions here. Yeah. So John Carpenter didn't get everything right, but boy, did he hit something on the head there.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that Air Force One was... inside of it is a...
An escape pod?
A Mork from Ork egg that's red that the president can get into if he ever needs to. And
it
I didn't
matches
know,
his hokas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the president, if he's captured... has a briefcase attached to his wrist.
Chained to his wrist.
Yeah, and inside the briefcase is a very important cassette tape.
Yeah, I think it's Brian Adams' single. Yeah.
Put it in your pocket, President, because they're going to get it out of the case if they capture you, bro. There's no reason to carry the case. Go ahead.
Yeah, the president ends up in New York through this process, and once there is essentially held hostage by the Duke of New York, this controlling presence in the prison.
But did the Duke have a ride or what?
Oh, man. Oh, chandeliers or candelabras? What do we call that? Chandeliers mounted over the headlights? Beautiful. Is that a Lincoln or an LTD?
I don't know, but in 1981, the presentation of 1997 cars was...
Well, they're repurposing. Now, that you can forgive, because this is in New York that's been abandoned. But right, but still, you know. Anyway,
go ahead.
The Duke of New York is holding him. And so what happens is we have a new inmate who has just arrived, but one who has a background.
Clearly, everyone knows his name.
Military operations, was the youngest person ever recognized by the president. Mm-hmm. For valor in battle. But he also has turned to a life of crime. Something. So now he's being put in. But they make him an offer here.
He can't refuse.
That he can't refuse, literally. That if he can extract the president from the island, that he will be allowed to go free.
Mm-hmm. Or his carotid arteries will explode.
That's right. Now, this character's name... is Plissken. You Snake can call Plissken. Him Snake.
That's right. Call me Plissken.
My favorite line in the whole movie is when, you know, he's going in to do the rescue and this woman says, "You're a cop." He says, "No, I'm just an asshole."
Good distinction to make.
You know. I mean, like I said, it came out when I was 9. By the time I was 12, 13, it was a slumber party staple.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't get it that young. I was more like 3 when this came out. That did not come to me until the 90s when I had already seen some other John Carpenter films. Certainly had seen The Thing, had seen Halloween probably. And I think at some point a friend of mine was like, oh, making reference to Snake Plissken. And I'm like, who's Snake Plissken? And sure enough, you know, we had the video and we watched that. And now I know who Snake Plissken is.
But weren't you impressed by all the actors in there that are now sort of like famous names? I mean, Adrienne Barbeau was John Carpenter's girlfriend.
That's right. And she was in The Fog before this with him. And
but
so
Harry Dean Stanton, Ernest Borgnine.
Oh, my God. Ernest Borgnine is a childhood favorite for sure.
Isaac Hayes was the Duke. Chef.
Damn right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a stacked cast. Although one that was pretty explicitly chosen, right? The people backing this, the people with the money, wanted Carpenter to use a bigger name as the lead, right? Kurt Russell was not their choice. Kurt Russell was coming off of being a Disney star,
right?
He had been this sort of youthful, boyish, you know, teenage Disney star. This was, from what I understand, really the first role where he kind of took on a more adult persona in a convincing way.
I watched the Siskel and Ebert review of the film, and Ebert describes Kurt Russell as, you might know him from playing Elvis on TV or some early Disney movies, like the computer wore tennis shoes, I think was one of, there was a year later, The Thing, you know, and now Kurt Russell's off and running. It is funny to see a futuristic film that was shot in 1981.
Oh, yeah.
You laugh a lot during this movie. Well, not intentionally, but because it hasn't aged depending on how you look at it, it hasn't aged.
Though think about, it's funny, right? 2001 came out, what was that, 68, 69?
Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh.
That film does not feel dated in the way that Escape from New York
maybe
feels.
A little bit of the war, like the stewardesses.
The computer stuff feels dated.
Some of it, I hear
but
you.
But not too
but
bad.
But they're actually pretty good about, like, I feel like Kubrick knew, like, stay away from graphic displays because that's going to be the thing that gives you away. We're going to be able to improve this. When you see the maps and you see the way that, like, it's like
when you see the cell phones, the satellite phones that are as big as a shoebox.
Right.
No,
right.
I remember those.
Well, those, yes, right. So it does have some of that. Now, watching this again, this hadn't, I hadn't watched this at least in a decade.
Oh, it's been a while.
And I will say it's still enjoyable. I still enjoyed myself watching it. It's not as enjoyable as when I first saw it. I will say this is a film, like, whereas The Thing, mm-hmm. Halloween, mm-hmm. most of the other films that we mentioned, I feel like are Carpenter films that over time I've gained more appreciation, where I appreciate how they were put together and what they were able to achieve. This is one that I think only slightly, not in like a huge way, has declined a little bit in my estimation, if only because – you know, again, the aging of the graphics.
It's a B movie.
It is, and it doesn't pretend to be other than that. So I don't hold it against it, but it does not. When I saw it in the 90s, I remember feeling, ooh, this is kind of like a rough-edged action film.
Well, we had lower expectations in the 90s.
That's right. Yeah, maybe.
You know?
Yeah,
but,
I certainly did.
But, you know, when I was thinking about it, I thought, well, what parallels are there to the Civil War? You have a dysfunctional president who's been captured.
Absolutely.
You have a divided nation where it's unclear where the loyalties are. There's certainly a lot of very casual violence in it. And it's almost campy.
Oh,
it's
super campy now. Yeah.
I'm at IMDb, best action films of 1981 by rating. Number 7, Thief. 6, Escape from New York, Excalibur.
We've done,
Let's skip on ahead. The For Your Eyes Only, the Bond installment of 1981, And then number 1, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh.
Now, Raiders of the Lost Ark, I guess probably shot at the same time as Escape from New York, more or less a little overlap, a different type of action movie, which seems to be where Hollywood headed.
Yeah.
But you know, when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, I remember this because I went to see it for my 24th birthday. And my girlfriends and I were watching it because we had to drive 70 miles to Madison to see it. When they had the little airplane flying over the map and stuff, we were like, is this real or is this supposed to be like a 50s movie? I mean, I think a lot of people had that experience. Yeah. It was like we didn't exactly know what it was supposed to be.
Are you making fun of this? Are you just doing
right.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But let's talk about the tattoo, huh?
Please, I mean...
What about it, Pam?
Once Snake gets disrobed a bit, gets ready for his fight.
Man, he loses that shirt pretty quick.
Oh, yeah.
See, the thing about the reason why this is a sleepover film is that watching it now at my age and many, many years later, this is a little boy fantasy film. There are jets and there are gangs, a lot of warriors. Remember, of course, John Carpenter after Dark Star did Warriors before he did
and
Halloween.
And women with large breasts.
Well, are there any other kind of women?
I mean, one prominent like, one who's constantly reminding you with, I mean.
Well, you would think that inside the prison where the prisoners get to do whatever they want to, and there's like 30 days left of food, I think it's mentioned, there is plenty of hair product and makeup available in the Dwayne Reed's.
That's a natural curl that Barbeau has.
I'm talking about the henchman with moosed up hair.
Yeah, flock of seagulls. Yeah.
But you've got the action stuff. You've got Jake Plissken, which seems Snake Plissken, which seems to come 13%, my friend.
Jake Plissken.
Seems to be out of some kind of central casting for tough dude.
He's like pre-Rambo.
Yeah, eye patch.
Sure.
Yep. Yeah, he doesn't have Stallone's
barely,
build. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
But him shirtless with his build is clearly we're gonna put that on screen. The tattoo coming out of his pants. It's a snake.
Pugachev's cobra right there. Yeah.
I was gonna say or a python.
Yeah.
But then you get to the gladiator style where, for the sake of the Duke, we're going to put on a show, which is like a half MMA before MMA exists, half...
It's the Roman Colosseum.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And how we, through time, have always regarded violence as sport, as being something to appease the masses. That's exactly what the Duke is doing here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a baseball bat with spikes with nails driven through it and a trash can lid, and that's our gladiator garb.
Yeah.
The girl with the big boobs, the cool, the cars that are retro, you know, yeah. It's all a little boy fantasy. That's what this movie is. And I think that that's why it's got such a acclaimed cult status, is because it does tickle an itch inside at least boys. That's why I was really excited for Pam to give her. Did you see this one?
Does it touch the boy inside of you, Pam?
Well, you know, this is before VHS.
Sure, and, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was before home movies were widely available. Sure. And I was living in a very small town. And so if you wanted to see the newest movies, you had to drive to Madison, which was yeah. like 70 miles away. But consider the fact that Road Warrior came out the same year.
Right.
And Road Warrior was so – it was like nothing anybody had ever seen before.
Right.
You know, Kurt Russell was something that most people had seen in Disney movies. Now, my friend Barbara Riley, who studied film as part of her art degree, uh-huh. swears that in between Disney and this movie, he was doing soft porn in – San Francisco with the Kuchar brothers, uh-huh. who were two directors who did underground films. And if you have never watched their short underground film clips, they are an absolute hoot. Oh my God, they are so funny. In the face of normal moral conventions and things like that. And she swears, but I have no experience of that. That's what I'm just saying.
I don't know how to talk about this movie. I mean, it is such a product of the era that it was yeah. made.
I mean, I think what you said was important, because I think part of what I was experiencing when I rewatched it is I'm not the age I was when I saw this film in the 90s, which I wasn't a little kid, but I was probably 14, 15, uh-huh. still close enough to the young man stage that things like, you know, Adrienne Barbeau's cleavage was probably enough to make me rate a movie 7 or 8 out of 10.
Sure.
On top of that, Kurt Russell, the badassery, the Snake Plissken, like
don't you
just
think
the name.
Snake was a more relatable character for adolescent boys than like Mel Gibson and Road Warrior, where it's like
oh,
you
sure.
didn't want to be in a room with him?
No, way more, absolutely. I mean, Road Warrior is a rougher and better film in some way. I think it's a better film.
Great.
I think it's a better film.
It's a great film.
But I think this is still a really good film. It has a little bit more of that kind of adolescent mentality to it that I think is there in a lot of Carpenter, but it gets balanced.
Definitely.
But it gets balanced, I think, with maybe the seriousness of the, sure. the horror.
But, you know, it is tightly filmed. I mean, sure. if there is something in common with Civil War, I mean, I think he knew what he was doing. I think he just didn't care about making high art.
No, and I think, you know, what you said about this is there is a camp factor to this. And I think part of what I enjoy more now than I did then is that there is a silliness and an over-the-topness, and it is definitely leaning into that. It is not shying away from it, and I'm there for it. I enjoy that part of it.
And when things are bad, don't you sort of want the easy laugh? I mean, because I think of what other movies came out in the mid to late 70s, Blazing Saddles, which every time I see it on TV, I still laugh.
Yeah.
Animal House.
Sure.
Classic. Which was a lot like people I knew in college. And you know, they were movies that were easy to laugh at because they had caricatures of people in it that you could sort of relate to bits of yeah. without really worrying about having to be the, you know,
yeah.
really bad person.
Yeah, no, I think this was definitely part of the moment that, you know, this film came out in. Comedy was just more of a and like broad comedy was
yeah.
more of a presence in theaters
and
than
physical
it is
comedy
now.
Also.
Yeah. You yeah, know. For sure.
I think the writing is horrible. I think that the acting is
he
horrible.
He wrote it.
But it's intentionally bad. Don't you think some
no,
of the dialogue
I don't think it's I don't think he said let me write a bad script. I think that we're looking at this now fast forwarded. So it's difficult. I mean, you always want to put it in context of the year that it came out. This is not a film that we're going to compare to an Alex Garland project where New York is walled and it's going to look and feel different. But the effects at the time, you can tell, were pretty state of the art.
Yeah.
He was doing everything he could. It just has this look about it that screams 1981, guessing 1999. And if you can get past that, and I do, you're just in for a silly, silly good time.
What I will say about the dialogue is I take it as this is like a campy stab at hard-boiled dialogue.
Like, I mean, like there's one point where the guy he's negotiating with about, you know, getting set free, he's like...
Lee Van Cleef,
well, Snake,
by the way.
Yeah.
And he's like, call me Plissken.
Call me Plissken.
And he calls him Plissken. He's like, I'm Snake.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, no, right. He's just going to... snappy. Yeah. There's a terseness to it. Like, again, hard-boiled. It's not as punchy as it really pretends to be. Mm-hmm. Or and there's something funny
the
about
most
just...
that often you're, repeated yeah. line, I thought you were dead.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a scene where he takes...
But everybody knows him.
Yeah, there's a scene where he's hiding out in a building in New York with a blonde girl is there. And I'm not with the Skulls. I've just taken up with the Turks. Like, there's gangs that are in this prison city. And then all of a sudden, hands burst up through the ground and drag her down underground. I guess we're not going to see her anymore, you know? And it's just this...
I believe that was his then-wife. I believe that the woman playing that character...
Was Kurt Russell?
I saw that and I thought, future zombie films.
Yes, there you go. Oh, absolutely.
There's a horror element to that.
Oh, yeah. The bursting out of the floorboards moment is
and then
for
dragging
sure
her down and
it feels
she's
very
gone.
Zombie, yeah.
But who were they? What were they trying to get? You know, were they eating her? We'll never know.
Dude, you don't question what goes on in Waldorf, Manhattan. No,
you don't. I enjoyed the movie very much. Everyone that is listening to this podcast has already seen it. Is it worth a revisit? Yeah, it kind of is.
And it's as maybe
free on Amazon with ads.
It's worth a revisit with alcohol.
Well, and as a sort of like palate cleansing chaser to Civil War, mm-hmm. I think it works pretty well,
it delivers
actually.
That. You're right,
I think, you know, if I'm going to go through Civil War, give myself the little like release of, because it's not giving me release, give myself the release of Escape from New York later.
Except it makes you realize that 40 some years ago, people were having dystopian films about the overthrow of the U.S. government.
Yeah.
So it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Which I think of Donald Pleasance as the president.
Oh, he was such a ick.
He's not presidential in appearance.
He was a whiner. He was a whiner.
I don't know. He's a white guy. It worked well enough.
But by then, he was firmly in Carpenter's
Didn't
stable.
You love the line in Civil War when he goes to the president and he's like, give me a quote. Mm-hmm. He's like, don't kill me.
Tell
him
to shoot me.
That'll do.
Good enough.
Yeah, good enough. Yeah.
Well, two great films this week.
Yeah.
Two great beers.
I mean, what am I going to complain about with this one? Yeah. To me, this is... Now, it's interesting because this is a 2018. It's funny. We just, in the first half, we were talking about freshness in beer. Mm-hmm. And how here we are with a beer that is
Five years old.
Six years.
Year is
we're 2024.
2018, pre-pandemic.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's a little of the zest for life that we once had still in this bottle. No, but seriously, it's amazing because what I said in the first half, I stand by. A darker, richer beer is going to be able to stand up over time in a way that a lighter, more hop-reliant beer is not going to be able to. And to me, I can't tell you what this tasted like fresh because I didn't have a bottle of this fresh.
Right.
I've held on to this for 6 years. Mm-hmm. So having it now, though, I love it. It tastes exactly what I was getting in the nose. It's like brownie batter. It's definitely got some of the maple note there that comes in. Which actually gets me thinking, like, I need to come up with a recipe for brownies that incorporates maple into it. I think that actually could be fun.
I think the right person's in the room to concoct a recipe.
I'd collaborate with her. How about
I'm gonna put that on for after hours.
The flavor here is there.
Yeah.
There's nothing missing in this sip. 13%. Oh my gosh. I am feeling it. Thank you, Pugachev's Cobra. What the brewery on this hangar?
Hangar 24.
I love it when you're enthusiastic, David.
Yeah. This is bottle number 4325 out of a total of 6,500 produced.
Is that empty?
So you feel, no, you got another sip in there. We were saving it for you. I like the alcohol on the flavor. Yeah. I don't mind a hot alcohol beer. If everything else
this would
around.
Be really good with ice cream.
Mm. Just pour it over the top.
You're not kidding. Yeah, like an affogato with
an affogato with this instead of your Frangelico.
Yeah.
That would be very nice. Mm. If everything around it is hitting, then I don't mind a hot alcohol note. And I don't mind it here at all. This is fantastic, David. And the idea that you bought this 6 years ago for us to open it all today seems a little bit like kismet. Fantastic. Loved it.
Great episode.
Loved it.
Boy.
Pam, thank you so much. I hope you'll hang out for after hours. Yep.
I've got written down.
It was about a year ago that I came in and did Jean Dielman.
Jean Dielman?
Yeah, it was right was after the Bammies.
Yeah, was it that long ago? It was. Yeah.
After the Bammies, we started that series.
The 10 top that we had, and sound the ones list. That we hadn't covered. Yeah.
Okay, how did we pick Pam for this episode? Top shelf and some hop dishes.
Top chef.
What
top
did I say?
Chef. You said top shelf.
Although I am top shelf.
Yeah. 70 miles to Madison to see Raiders of the Lost Ark. What was in Madison? I saw the trailer for Maxine, which I can't wait to talk about. Yeah. And then, I watched WrestleMania. We're going to be talking about all of that in After Hours, patreon.com/beerandamoviepodcast. But that's only one place that the conversation doesn't continue. You can catch us on Facebook, Instagram, X, not so much X, but you either got to start doing something with that or getting rid of it. But beerandamoviepodcast.com is a place to go listen to the episode live, or you can look at some different look at some different collections.
Yeah, collections of episodes.
Of episodes. Yeah. The Carpenter episode, for example, episode 61, a direct link to that kind of thing. The Aronofsky episode, the Wes Anderson episode, yada, yada, yada.
Yada.
Discord is where we are as well. And like we said, patreon.com/beerandamoviepodcast. If you haven't been over there yet, go ahead and check this out, because After Hours is so, so much fun. Wherever you're listening, go ahead and rate, review, subscribe, all of the things that in podcast world you know that we would love for you to do. This has been a...
Dystopian,
feisty episode of Beer in a Movie. Until next time.
Warm up the choppers. We're moving in.